Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While historian Michael Wallace is best known for his work documenting the history and the landmarks of Route 66 and, more recently, the Lincoln Highway, the bulk of his work has been in writing about the mythic figures and subjects both here in Oklahoma and the American West. From stories of outlaws and oil men like Pretty Boy Floyd, Billy the Kid, or Frank Phillips, to subjects that really have truly become mythic, like Davy Crockett, or the subject of his latest book, The Donner Party. The Donner-Reed Party, as it's officially known, today is a footnote to the history of manifest destiny and westward expansion. This ill-fated wagon train is best known for becoming trapped in the Sierras by winter snows and forced to consume the dead members of their party in order to survive. In his book, The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny, Wallace tells a larger story, the story of westward expansion, the story of the party and the two families that led the group. Some were seeking more riches, others were escaping financial ruin. Still others were simply adventurers. He says the group was a cross-section of America at the time. The book has its launch party tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa Historical Society at 24th and Peoria. He'll be talking about the book and signing as well. Michael Wallace is our guest today. Michael Wallace, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Your last couple books have been looking at sort of these mythic characters of the West, Billy the Kid, Davy Crockett. And this book is even probably more of a, almost a punchline of a joke anymore about the Donner Party. The Donner Party who set off across the West, got stranded right around Lake Tahoe and snowed in. And then, of course, to survive, as people died, parts of the party consumed some of the dead to survive. Three rescue attempts to made on them, and nothing happened until the snow melted in the spring. It's a factoid of the West, but really people do not know the story, and the story is very fascinating.
Indeed it is, and you hit it right on the head. Throughout the last couple of years, when people ask me, what are you working on? And if I would say, oh, it's a book about the Donner Party, they'd invariably, if they knew of the Donner Party, and most of them did or thought they did, they would say, oh, the Donner Party. Aren't those the pioneers who got trapped in the mountains in the snow and ate each other? And I would, of course, say, well, that is part of the story. If that survival cannibalism hadn't taken place, we would know the Donner Party from a ham sandwich. They would have slipped over the Sierras like everyone else and made a life or not in California. But in fact, they were trapped in the Sierras. So we have this great story, but it's a story that begins long before the Donners started their journey in a wholly different place. And all of those individuals involved had their own story to tell. So what I did, as I did with, as you suggested, with Billy the Kid and Crockett, is unwind the myth and the half-truths and the yarns about them to expose the real story, the true story, which is always the better story.
And, of course, as the subtitle suggests, this is also another story about manifest destiny, which in this historical realm, it's sort of a two-edged sword today. I think if you ask most people, people would say they were very glad manifest destiny happened because it ended up in the modern United States, unless you're a Native American. But for historians today, it's almost like, well, this is sort of the seamy side of American history, and this is very much at the heart of the Donner story.
You're totally correct. It's a book about the foibles, the follies, the arrogance of Manifest Destiny told through the eyes of the foot soldiers of Manifest Destiny, the Donner or Donner-Reed Party.
One of the things that surprised me very earlier is when I think of the people that headed west, I always thought of this as the people who couldn't get a foothold within the boundaries of the United States civilization. You know, I'm saying, you know, if you were around the time of the 13 colonies, you moved to Kentucky, you moved to Ohio because you couldn't get a foothold in those original 13 colonies. If you lived in Ohio, Kentucky, or Illinois, you moved further west. You moved, went to Oregon. But what was really interesting to me is the Donners do not fit that story.
No, indeed. And many members of the Donner Party don't fit that story. But the Donners themselves, primarily two older brothers, George and Jacob Donner, were very prosperous farmers in Sangamon County, Illinois, near Springfield. And they had done what you described. They had been gypsy-footed and moved like so many people did across the frontier as the frontier moved from the Carolinas to Kentucky to Indiana and finally to Illinois. They even made a little pilgrimage for a year. That's all it lasted, down to the Texas coast. But that didn't last. They didn't find that suitable, so they came back to Illinois, and they had it made, literally.
They were prosperous.
They were very prosperous. And again, as many others were. But you had to have a little prosperity in order to afford to go.
That's true. You had
to buy that whole rig. You had to buy that wagon. You had to buy yokes of oxen, teams of oxen. You had to have a little substance in order to make the trip. So there's a little bit of stereotype there. It's kind of like a Harley rider. Everybody sees Harley riders in black on their loud cycles, and they think, oh, God, these are some kind of low-life bikers. And it turns out most of the Harley riders are orthodontists and dentists and college professors. So, you know, it's...
You got to afford the bike.
You got to afford the bike. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Tell us a little about the Donners. You mentioned they moved west, but it seems like at every stop they got a little more prosperous. And was this going to be the big score, moving to California or Oregon? Because I think they were divided on whether they wanted to go to Oregon or California.
Well, a lot of people were divided. A lot of people, there were large numbers, taking the trail that was really the Oregon-California trail to a dividing point way out west where they had the parting of the ways. And some went up to Oregon, some continued into California. And that California trail became very popular. But in the case of the two Donner brothers, they were always set on going to California, as was a very, very important character in this story, James Reed, James Frazier Reed, who also came from Springfield. And it was those three families, the greater George Donner family and his wife Tamsin and their children, including some children from a prior marriage, and his younger brother, Jacob Donner, often mistakenly thought to be his older brother, and his wife and their children. And then you had James Reed with his family and his infirm mother-in-law, and then their various teamsters and hired hands. So that little entourage that left Springfield in April 46 was the nucleus of what eventually came to be called the Donner Party, or some historians refer to it properly as the Donner-Reed Party.
And actually, James Reed does more fit the stereotype, doesn't he? Because he had lost everything.
He had lost everything, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
But he had a young, very capable attorney who was able to help him with many legal issues and, in fact, helped him close to the time they left in 46, help him stash some money during the bankruptcy proceedings, money that really came in handy later.
And this is a fairly obscure guy in American history, isn't he?
Yeah, this young attorney who really wanted to go with the Donners. And
yes,
they almost had him convinced, James Reed did, because this attorney had been a messmate with him in the Black Hawk War. Now, that much people in history really knew about this lawyer, that Reed had been together in that brief Black Hawk War. But it was probably good that in the end this young lawyer didn't go. His wife was firmly against it. She had a toddler and was pregnant with another child. He had what appeared to be a promising political career. And in fact, if they had gone, instead of becoming 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln could have ended up an entree in the Sierras.
That's true. And, of course, there was another opportunity where he was going to be, I'm not sure, was an ambassador to Oregon or a territorial governor of Oregon.
Yeah.
That would have ended his career as well.
That would have ended his career as well.
So where did you find this information? Has this ever been reported before?
sort of report it.
Okay.
It's here and there. It's very vague. As far as my research, which one of my fortes is digging for those nuggets, here we had a subject, again, like Crockett, like Billy the Kid, many, many books written about it, but most of the focus on the obvious out in the Sierras. I knew there had to be more material lurking, and I was able to tap into archives from Yale University to the University of California and all places in between, but I also was able, thankfully, to form a relationship with a man named Bill Springer, who lives in suburban New Orleans. And Bill Springer is, in fact, a Donner. He's the great-great-grandson of George Donner, and in fact, the head, if you will, or leader of the Donner descendants. People don't know this, but a lot of figures from history have groups, you know, not groupies, but groups.
Of descendants. Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, big
Sally
time.
Hemings.
Sally Hemings has her own. And by the way, those two names come up in the book.
Yeah.
But the Donners had theirs, just like the Davy Crockett descendants. And you damn near have to show your DNA to get in there. There are the Donner descendants. And Bill Springer and his late brother Don Springer were natives of Springfield. And there are still Donners and other related people in that Springfield area, but literally across the United States. So I was exposed to all of that
family
material,
yeah,
which is always helpful. And that's what I did with Bill Springer. And he worked with me. And his book blurb on the back of my book is more valuable to me than Jim Lehrer's or my friend Larry McMurtry's, although I greatly appreciate their endorsements, because Bill Springer gave me the stamp of approval from the party.
My guest today is historian Michael Wallace. His new book is titled The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. It's published by Live Right, and this is an amazing story about this party and really a lot of detail on everything that was needed. And just from the very first days of the journey, this seems star-crossed. They're bringing all sorts of unnecessary things to the West, things that you could send for after you're established there. It takes them 2 days to get out of Springfield.
Right.
Which sort of sets the tone in a way.
Totally sets the tone. And of course, any moment lost cannot be made up. And that ultimately, of course, is what caused their demise. And of course, there's a resurrection out of that demise.
Yeah.
But yeah, it took a long time. A good example of overdoing it, James Reed had to take his sick mother-in-law, Sarah Keyes, with him. She demanded to go. She already had a son out west, and she wanted to see him before she died. So they loaded this poor elderly woman in a big feather bed set up in an unusually large wagon, which even had a cook stove in it, with a chimney coming out the roof and a side door, much like a cabin door. And that's where she resided until her death, which happened very, very soon after they left the United States into Indian country. That cook stove and feather bed, of course, ended up in the desert sands of what's now Utah. So many things were dropped off along the way. And this was typical of a lot of the wagon caravans. They overthought it. They overdid it. They brought entire libraries. They brought fine liquors. They brought, entire wardrobes. They brought too much because they didn't know what they were facing, and they didn't know what it would be like once they got to California.
You know, the thing about it is when you're driving out I-80 across Nebraska, this is right alongside the Oregon Trail.
The Platte River.
Yeah, right along the Platte River. You know, every 12 minutes, as you're driving along at 70, 75 miles per hour, that's a midsummer day's journey. Every 10 minutes,
yeah.
That's a whole day. It really is amazing to follow that trail. Just to consider, compared to today, modern day, how long this journey takes.
You're so right. I remember when I was doing field research on this book and my wife Suzanne and I were out, and I've followed it many times. I got involved with heavily in the Donner Party trail when I did years ago my Lincoln Highway book, because Lincoln Highway, parts of the California Trail, is in fact the Lincoln Highway, long parts of it. So I knew a lot of that country already. But when we were traveling from Springfield all the way out to the sea, our own experiences were interesting. I remember one night, and we were in mid-northern Missouri making our way to Independence and the Missouri River crossing as it comes down and makes its journey to the confluence of the Mississippi. And we ran into a rainstorm. It was the most incredible, amazing rainstorm I ever faced. Lightning was continuous, thunder. We couldn't drive. The roads were flooded. I inched along. It was madness. And I had to think to myself, what if we were in under a canvas of a wagon? What if we were trying to maneuver herds of cattle and children and dogs and mules in a lightning alone? Lightning, of course, killed a lot of people on the trail. Then later in the trip, when we're out along the Platte River in Nebraska, that very shallow river, and we've waded through all these grasses and weeds to get to the Platte, to actually get to the water, which was interesting. It looks very much like the same as it did then. When we got out of that grass, we were covered with chiggers and ticks, and all the way back to the motel room, air conditioned, hot showers, a steak dinner that night, get rid of all these critters. The bites lingered. I had to think again. Wow, what this must have been like. And I know it was. It was incredibly difficult, just the contact with nature itself, more so than even what they were really afraid of were Native Americans. They were afraid of Pawnees or others who might sweep down on them. And they had some problems later on, a lot of problems they brought on themselves. But it was really nature that stopped the Donners.
So it was nature, but it was also some poor decision-making. And also you mentioned there was a murder. You know, we think of the cannibalization after people died in the Sierras, but there was actually a murder on the trail. Was that pretty rare for a murder among the party?
Actually, it wasn't that rare. It didn't happen on every party. But what happened with these wagon caravans, and as you find out, once the Donners get in with their units in the reeds to Independence, then they strike out from that jumping off point where they've provisioned and ready. And then eventually, very soon, they catch up with a larger wagon caravan. And that was typically what happened. Caravans would join, smaller ones would join larger ones. And then those changed because people didn't like the pace of the journey. That was certainly true with the Donner Party. Many of their caravan members, especially single men, were weary of the slow pace because of the cattle, the oxen, everything. And they eventually got out of there and traded their wagons and things in at a fort for pack mules, which were much faster. And they, in fact, got to California much sooner than the Donners. But there were also disagreements because as this thing played out, anxiety rose and tempers flared because of the accidents, the incidents, all the pestilence, everything that they faced. It preyed on them. And pretty soon what you had were individual families just taking care of themselves. You no longer had typically that cooperation. The murderer was a very prominent man in the party, one of the main characters, if you will, of this book. And as a result, he was banished from the party and went ahead to California and had an incredible round of adventures, including being drafted as an officer in the Mexican-American War in Alta California. He had to fight a skirmish there, then come back, then put together rescue parties, And that story in itself is amazing. But the murder was very typical. It was brought on. It wasn't a premeditated murder. It came out of a heated argument. And a knife was drawn and used. So these things did happen. And besides that murder, there were actually more murders, if you stop to think about it, because eventually two of the immigrants admitted to, instead of helping a young man they went back to, admitted they killed him for his loot. And then another old man was just left abandoned, just like the ponies and horses were left abandoned, left to die on the road. And the most interesting murders of all, two Miwok Indians who had been sent out by John Sutter from his fort to help the survivors, and they eventually end up being shot and killed for food. And why? Because they were subhuman. They weren't human. That's how the people rationalized it.
So what caused the party not to make it to California? Was it a matter of poor planning, events of nature, or was it their own poor decision-making and making enough travel to get there before the snows set in?
Well, it was all of the above. All of those items you just mentioned. Plus, talking about bad advice, the person that many historians and others have blamed as the main culprit is a man named Lansford Hastings, who wrote early on this guidebook to the Oregon and California Trail. And in that guidebook was a very brief passage about a shortcut out in what's now Utah, to roundabout below the Great Salt Lake and eventually wind back to the normal or regular California Trail. James Reed was enthusiastic about this. Everyone read that guidebook, and they read the writings of Fremont and anything they could get their hands on as research before they left. So some of them were convinced from the get-go that this Hastings Cutoff, as it was called, was the way to go. Even though out on the trail, as you'll read, they met wisdom keepers, John Clyman, an old mountain man, and an old friend of James Reed, even though he warned them and others, don't take that cutoff. Hastings hasn't even taken it himself. It's unproven. Don't do it. And then they were lied to. They were lied to by, among other people, Jim Bridger, another old mountain man, who didn't want them to take that regular trail. He wanted them on the Hastings cutoff so his trading post could make a little money off of them. And so he intentionally didn't give them the letters of warning not to take the trail that were left behind for them. So if you put all of that together, it spells disaster.
Now, once they got to Truckee, that's when they get snowed in, and they basically made a winter camp. Three rescue attempts. The first one, as you mentioned, was the scouts. They shot them and consumed them.
Yes.
To me, that would be sort of the end of the rescue attempts, but all these, you know, you don't hear about that. There were numerous attempts to try to get them out.
Well, the two Miwoks, Luis and Salvador, were not killed in the survival camps at Truckee Lake or down on Alder Creek. They were killed because they were accompanying a band of about 15 immigrants who struck out on their own out of desperation to try to reach so-called civilization, a group that became known as, later, the Forlorn Hope. Mm-hmm. And that's when they were killed. But eventually, it was the Forlorn Hope. It was members of that party that were the first ones to have to rely on eating the flesh of the dead, which they did. And those survivors finally made it in. Yeah, and it became known that the Miwoks were killed. But once again, you're not going to get in trouble for killing an Indian in California if you're a white man.
Yeah. So what was the reaction once the survivors did come out? Was it a matter of, were they lionized? Were they pitied, despised, or a bit of all?
A little bit of all of the above, but mostly and primarily they became the subject of total yellow journalism, sensationalism. The stories of their plight were greatly, greatly exaggerated. Exaggerated by even some of them in a way and some of the rescuers. The newspapers of the day in California, and then, of course, that spread across the back into the United States, told of cannibal camps where people were killed and taken apart. It sounded not like survival cannibalism or even ritualistic cannibalism, the main two types, but just this devilish, ghoulish type of cannibalism. And cannibalism, just on the face of it, of course, is one of our greatest taboos, right up there with bestiality and incest. So the Donner Party, again, the Donner-Reed Party, those people were met with a lot of scorn and ridicule, but some were able to overcome that. And some people understood what they went through. So generally, through time, those people themselves became accepted and acceptable. Some of them, especially the females who had been young girls on the trail, some of them never again talked about it. Others of that same group wrote books about it or talked to journalists about
it. And most of the survivors, I mean, a good portion of the survivors were children, which is interesting, you would think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were older children. It is very interesting. Some of the first to die were infants, you know, babies in arms, and older people. But a lot of the older children, of course, did survive. In fact, the only survivors from the actual two Donner families were children. The four adults, George and Jacob and Tamsin and Betsy, they perished and were eventually cannibalized. But another interesting fact is some of the first ones to die and didn't survive were the young, healthy, strong men, 18, 19-year-old teamsters and hands who were going out west for adventure or to find a new life or just see what they could see, because they exerted so much physical energy. And more importantly, they did not have a family unit. And those family units, although they could be very selfish and cold and cruel to other families or individuals, they stuck together. And those mothers kept those families going. So you had many more females survive in general than males.
Name of the book is The Best Land Under Heaven. Michael, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, as always.
Historian Michael Wallace speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. It's published by Live Right. He'll be having a launch party for the book tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa Historical Society at 24th and Peoria. He'll be talking about the book and then signing the book afterwards. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.